This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Biomega Fish Oil from Biotics Research. For over 40 years, Biotics Research has been providing the highest quality supplements, surpassing industry standards. Biomega Fish Oil contains therapeutic doses of vital omega-3s in the triglyceride form, which is highly bioavailable. Biotics Research ensures maximum purity and freshness by managing their fish oils from catch to capsule, verified by rigorous independent testing. For more information, go to drhoffman.com/biotics research. That's drhoffman.com/biotics research for Biomega Fish Oil. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today we're going to talk to Dr. Tim Spector, author of Spoon Fed, subtitle, Why Almost Everything We've Been Told About Food Is Wrong. That's a book that's just out as a trade paperback. You can find it from the usual sources. Dr. Spector is an internationally recognized expert in gut health and a professor of genetic epidemiology at King's College in London. He is also scientific co-founder of ZOE, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Z-O-E, and a senior researcher of the PREDICT study. And also, he's involved in tracking the COVID pandemic over there in the UK as the creator of the widely used COVID symptoms study app, which a lot of people are participating in, to track the pandemic. He's an expert in personalized medicine and food policy, as well as the gut microbiome. His previous book, The Diet Myth, is a bestseller, and he frequently appears on media, as well as in academic journals. So without further ado, here's Dr. Tim Spector. Dr. Spector, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine. Thanks for joining us.
It's a great pleasure for me too.
Well, first of all, you know, what's happening over there in the UK? You guys are experiencing the depths of the lockdown. I recently saw a picture of Regent Street, which is kind of like the Rodeo Drive or the Madison Avenue of London. And it's like a ghost town.
Yeah, the center of London is empty. All the shops are empty, all the closed down. All the restaurants are shut down. The only place that's really full are all the parks. Everyone is out walking whenever they can. So it's kind of a strange situation.
Yeah,
everybody's working from home.
Indeed, and there's concern about the new UK variant, which is said to be more contagious and potentially more deadly. So, you know, while there's encouraging information on the horizon, the proverbial light at the end of the tunnel with the vaccines and perhaps the waning of the pandemic, there's a lot of kind of mixed messages about where it's going. So in the book, Spoon Fed, the subtitle is Why Almost Everything We've Been Told About Food Is Wrong. So, how did you arrive at that conclusion?
Well, it was a bit of a long journey. It didn't happen overnight. Basically, I've done various things in my career. I started as a rheumatologist and then epidemiologist, and about 25 years ago started the twin research units studying 14,000 twins across the UK. And you know, I taught myself genetics, and of course, twins are ideal to mm-hmm. look at nature v nurture.
Right.
But the last 10 years, I started getting really interested in why identical twins were so often very different. So these genetic clones would end up with die of different diseases. One would get cancer, the other one wouldn't. One would be depressed, one would be happy. One would be overweight, the other skinny. And the idea that, you know, genes were everything suddenly, for me, was dispelled. And I was looking for reasons that identical twins should be different, given they'd lived most, you know, up to the age of 18 together and had very similar lives. And the one thing that I found that was really different was the gut microbes. And that was a sort of aha moment that said, if the microbes are different, that means, you know, nutrition really is key to our health because they're vital for our microbes and explains why we're all so different. And that's really where this story began, realizing that we'd completely disregarded the gut microbiome as a source of our nutrition advice. And so, we'd oversimplified it to calories and fats and sugars and forgot that it's all about this new organ in our body. And that for me was that pivotal moment. And then decided to really go into personalized medicine and trying to explain to people, tearing up the textbooks and just saying, you really need to look at nutrition from a completely different angle if you take it from the microbes point of view. And that's really the story. And that got me into being a sort of microbiome expert, doing this in a huge scale with thousands of people, using my genetic skills, and also teaming up with the company Zoe, pronounced Zoe rather than Zoe, to actually do huge experiments on thousands of people, including twins, to prove that everybody responds differently to food. And now what's great is they now have a commercial product in the US that you can actually buy and do your own testing. So that's a long journey in a short form. But on the way, I really discovered that we have so many food myths, and a lot of them are propagated by the food industry to keep us buying rubbish food. And that really is the essence of the book, where I look at 23 obvious food myths and dispel them and say why, because of the new science, it's obviously untrue.
Well, let's tackle some of those popular myths. And first and foremost is the myth that fat is the gunk that accumulates in our arteries. And it's kind of a very literal concept that, literally this yellow gunk, if we consume a high-fat diet, deposits in our arterial walls. And you tackle that in the book, right?
Yeah, so we've had this story for about 50 years that fat was a demon. And I'm sure if fat was called something else that wasn't related to the word for being overweight, mm-hmm. We'd probably have a much better relationship with it, but it isn't. And the epidemiology behind all that originally has turned out to be flawed. And we've demonized one part of our diet, and that's caused us to overeat on other bits of our diet and ignore some of the very good fats that we could be eating. And is one of the reasons why we've all become three times more obese in the last 40 years. The rates of obesity have increased. So it's focusing on one. It's a good example of how humans love a simple story, and we're all suckers, and myself included, we're all suckers for the single solution to everything that's easy. And of course, as soon as we do that, the food industry loved it because they just reformulated everything as low fat and added all kinds of other nasty chemicals and ingredients, made it even more processed. And as a result, our microbes suffered and our health suffered. And we became used to eating highly processed foods rather than natural fat-containing foods. So I think that's just a really good example. And we know that some people actually do very well on high-fat diets, and some people do badly on them. And there isn't, again, this comes back to this personalization element, there isn't one size fits all. I mean, we know that from Peter on, some people tolerate ketogenic diets very well, others very badly. And the idea that it's bad for everyone is just complete nonsense. Well, have all this stuff, have fats in it, like olive oil, extra virgin olive oil has plenty of saturated fat in it, but because of the other stuff in it, it's good for you. So it's all about oversimplification.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not one size fits all. And also, each food is a multiplicity of constituents. And, we tend to break it down to this is a high fat food or a low fat food, or this food has monounsaturated fats, or, and it's really the package. And it's also the diet in its totality. How close are we You know, since you're working with Zoe, now that I'm getting the pronunciation correctly, to some kind of predictive instrument to determine what is the best diet for a given individual. You know, you work with artificial intelligence. Now we have remarkable tools at our disposal to do metabolomics and, you know, high throughput stool analysis and, of course, saliva tests to give us the full array of our genes. How far along are we in terms of making predictions?
Well, we've been studying thousands of people for the last 3 years, and we published the first part of these results in Nature Medicine in June, which is a well-known journal. And basically, by combining, giving everyone identical foods, making them log all their foods for 2 weeks, and giving them a continuous glucose monitor, measuring their blood fat 6 hours after food, and measuring their microbes, we could put that together for an individual and, with about 80% predictive ability, be able to predict how they would respond to any other food. Hmm. So this is, then that was just the first sort of step at it. We're going to get better, but 80% is already pretty good. And this allows us to give people their food scores that are personalized for them, because we'll be able to say, with this, we know how, you know, your blood sugar will react, your blood fats will react, and this is going to be good or bad for your microbes. So, and you can only do this with these big AI, big data algorithms. It's impossible for anyone to sort that out themselves. And that's, so we now, for the last couple of months, we've actually been running this as a commercial product. People can actually get a home version of this test in the US. The company is based in Boston, and if people go on the website, joinzoe.com, they can actually test this out. If some of your listeners are actually interested in this, being pioneers in this self-experimentation. But I think it really is a sign of the future, because it's going to get even better. It's going to get even more sophisticated. It's going to get cheaper. And it's going to be something that everybody's going to be doing soon. And I think it's really going to change the way we think about nutrition, because, you know, it isn't simple. It is not. But, you know, if you just work out what foods are good for you and your body and your microbes, then, you know, a lot of these difficult decisions and reliance on food labels and the food industry and medical guidelines, you know, go out the window, really.
Okay, folks, at this point, let's pause and allow one of our sponsors an opportunity to share this vital message with you. This is Dr. Ronald Hoffman for a suite of professional-grade products from Protocol for Life Balance, which can help manage stress and promote a positive mood. Mucuna Puriens, 5-HTP, and L-Tryptophan. They support proper brain and nervous system function, relaxation, and restful sleep. Their ingredients are of the highest quality and backed by solid scientific data. They're available now at drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance. That's drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance for more information and to order. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting our sponsors. And now back to today's guest, Dr. Tim Spector. There's this thing, as you're well aware, the glycemic index and the glycemic load. And what they discovered recently, I think, you know, you may have participated in some of the research on this, but some of the lead researchers on this are from Israel. And they demonstrated that it's different strokes for different folks, depending on not just the carbohydrate composition and the fiber composition of the food, but how each person's body interprets the food. Very, very interesting research. We can't rely on a simple glycemic index, one size fits all.
Yeah. So we did, you know, we looked at that in these studies, because I said everyone had a glucose monitor, which records their everything for 2 weeks. And so we had millions of readings. And we could see that even when you gave identical twins, the identical muffins and the identical milkshakes, and gave them the same foods for 2 weeks, they responded differently to every meal. And so if identical twins are going to respond differently, both in terms of their blood sugar response and their triglyceride response, their inflammation, over time, that's going to have a huge effect on your metabolism and your likelihood of gaining weight, because we really don't want to have these inflammatory spikes going on in our system. So for me, that was quite a revelation to see that not only there was this eightfold difference between individuals in their response. And this is normal people. Right? Mm-hmm. We're not talking about diseased people. Normal people in response to the same muffins. Identical twins were also very different. And I think we can now show, we're now showing not just glucose peaks, but also, you know, some people have dips after eating carbs, that if you're a dipper, you end up actually being hungrier 3 hours later than mm-hmm. someone who doesn't have a dip, mm-hmm. which means that for some people, you know, and that comes back to this another myth, really, that you think about it, for two different people, the same muffin of identical calories has a really different effect. So all calories are absolutely not equal. And I think that these experiments are really showing it to us, because in the same way that, you know, highly processed food will give you more hunger, you know, perfectly normal food that just doesn't, your body just absorbs far too quickly, will also give you these hunger and alertness problems. And most of us are, you know, we don't know about this. We're happily eating what we're told is healthy, and because that's the standard practice. But mm-hmm. for us, it just may not be. And I've totally changed my diet, and I've noticed that what I eat and affects me badly, my wife can quite happily eat. Mm-hmm. So it's made breakfast time quite different. I end up with a very different breakfast to my wife's now because of, you know, my own self-discovery over the last few years.
And you talk about this concept in a chapter in your book, Spoon Fed, Calorie Counting Doesn't Add Up. And, you know, we used to take this thermodynamic model, you know, as if we were cars or steam engines, you know, calories in, calories out, you know, the notion that there's a thermodynamic equation and the fuel that we put in is offset by the exercise we do. You know, those of us who are deeply involved in nutrition recognize that that's simply too simplistic.
It is. And unfortunately, it is it's a myth that's persisted and really kept the whole diet industry going. And it's also, you know, that bit on the label that says low calorie or only, you know, 200 calories, it's covering up all the problems of the quality of the food. So it's dumbing down nutrition where to a number that instead of looking at all the contents and actually saying, actually, this isn't healthy for me, you're focusing on a number that is actually built on sand. There's only in broad terms is calories useful, because we can't measure it as an individual. You can't, even nutritionists, you know, unless they're weighing everything they eat, can't estimate their consumption. And we certainly can't measure how our body burns it accurately. You know, these wristwatches we're all wearing these days, they're useless at that. There's no way you can do that properly. So you add up the fact that you can't measure it, plus the fact that you've got these problems that different foods of the same calories will give you different effects, and the fact that no real calorie-restricted diets have worked long-term, really you can see that we really should ditch the calorie moving forward if we're going to really get to grips with good health and understand food properly.
One of the big initiatives that's coming to some extent out of the UK, because it's the Eat Lancet initiative, which is broadly supported by the World Health Organization, the United Nations, and global groups, is the initiative to curtail our intake of animal protein and to move us more towards a sustainable, that's a big word, sustainable diet for the sake of the planet, for the sake of our health. And again, it's a one-size-fits-all program. Is that going to ultimately serve the goal it's intended towards?
Well, I think it was an important statement that you could start equating health with the environment. And the fact that we haven't really had that strong debate before is a testament really to the power of the food industry that has huge vested interests in the meat and dairy industry. And I didn't believe everything in that report. But I think the concept that if now there's, you know, people have given up meat in the past for animal cruelty reasons and then health reasons. And now the big other reason, and certainly in the UK, which has three times as many vegetarians as the US, by the way, is the environment. It probably is the single most important thing all of us can do for the planet is actually to reduce our meat eating. Now, I'm not one to say we should never eat meat, and I personally have meat, you know, once a month. But I do think it's an very important landmark paper in estimating these effects. And what I found is that, in general, the foods that I think are healthy for us and our gut microbes tend to be also healthy for the planet. And I think if you can get all those ecosystems working together, then, you know, we can reverse some of the harms we've been doing to ourselves and the planet over the last 30 years by our obsession with cheap, hyper-processed foods and snacking and using up a lot of our resources, you know, such as cattle farming, in ways that we can now see a potential alternative. But I don't see it as, you know, just with artificial meat. I really just think all of us need to eat more plants.
Right. You talk a lot about ultra-processed food in your book. Can you give us a definition of ultra-processed food and why is it deleterious? What is it about, per se, about ultra-processed food that undermines our health?
Processed food is the term that used to be used a lot, but virtually everything like milk or cheese or chocolate is processed to some extent. Mm-hmm. So ultra-processed is...
Making peanut butter, for example, it's processed, but, you know, it's
processed, but it's... Good stuff is probably not ultra-processed. So ultra-processed doesn't resemble any of the original ingredients, and it's made from products of products, and usually has over 10 ingredients on the label, most of which you wouldn't find in a kitchen. So basically, it's like a chemistry... using extracts of all these plants rather than the actual plants themselves, so that certainly your grandparents wouldn't recognize it as food. And I think that's we're still struggling with the exact definitions, but in general it's something you don't recognize the original ingredients in it, and it contains more than 10 chemical products. And, you know, I think we still need to define this. And there are some countries now in South America putting black labels on things that are clearly ultra processed and telling kids to avoid them, because we didn't really know why they would be bad. There was this whole thing in the sort of start in the 80s about E numbers and additives and things. But people were rather vague about why they were bad for you. But I think we're now understanding why. And I think there's two reasons. One is the effects on the microbiome of all these chemicals, mm-hmm. and artificial sweeteners, emulsifiers that can have deleterious effects on the gut microbes themselves, because they're not used to be able to eat them. They just haven't evolved microbes that can do that. And the second is that when you give people two meals, or you randomize a trial into two meals, as Kevin Hall and his group at NIH have done, so identical calories, same meal, and you give them a starter meal, one cooked with whole foods, the other ultra-processed foods, and they were similarly pleasant, as they rated the same. Uh-huh. The group eating the ultra-processed food felt hungrier quicker.
Wow.
They came back for seconds. They ate more. So basically, it is sending chemicals to your brain to eat much more of it and overeat.
Yeah.
So they're the two reasons, really, that they've got it. You know, and in the US, 60% of all meals consumed are ultra-processed. It's the highest in the world.
Yeah. And among
not,
the among
that's
the
not about poverty. It's just about culture.
And statistics show that among the cohort of people who are the highest weight, or you know, that have the most susceptibility to obesity, that percentage even goes up, because I was, you know, that's the average intake across the board. So there definitely is a correlation. All right, great stuff. The book is Spoon-Fed: Why Almost Everything We've Been Told About Food Is Wrong. The author, our guest today, Dr. Tim Spector. When we return, more on food myths and why you should be disabused of them. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.